The I of this novel, who incidentally is not named Christopher Isherwood, but William Bradshaw, which were the two middle names of my full name. I dropped them when I became an American citizen because Christopher Isherwood is quite enough load to carry through life without the other two.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappelle. U.S. top court hears trans student sports ban cases, Malaysian authorities shut down empty gay-friendly hotel, and Isherwood's own stories of pre-war Berlin. All that and more this week, now that you've found This Way Out.
I'm Michael Taylor Gray.
And I'm Nico Raquel.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending January 17th, 2026. Can transgender athletes be banned from competing in U.S. government-funded school athletic programs? The United States Supreme Court heard oral arguments on January 13th in two cases that test the constitutionality of such bans. Their decision will touch virtually every public school or university because they all depend on some type of federal funding to cover operating costs. In the case of Little versus Hecox, 25-year-old Lindsay Hecox filed suit after Boise State University in Idaho rejected her efforts to try out for the women's track and cross-country teams. 15-year-old shot putter and discus thrower Becky Pepper Jackson is the plaintiff in West Virginia versus BPJ. Both states are challenging lower court rulings that supported the trans athletes. The cases zero in on the meaning of bias based on sex in the Constitution's Equal Protection Clause and the sex-based bias in education banned in Title IX of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Opponents of trans participation insist that trans females have a physical advantage over cisgender females because they were born with male physical dominance. Their claim lacks scientific evidence. Any such advantage is likely erased by gender-affirming care such as puberty blockers and hormone therapies. The High Court ruled that Title VII of the Civil Rights Act bans bias based on sexual orientation or gender identity in the workplace in the landmark Bostock versus Clayton County decision of 2020. Voting with the majority in that case, Chief Justice John Roberts wondered aloud if Bostock extends to school athletics. Based on the justices' questions and comments during the oral arguments, court watchers generally speculate that the conservative majority would support the trans bans. The Supreme Court's ruling is expected sometime in June. 27 of the 50 U.S. states specifically ban trans girls and women from competing in school sports. Trans boys and men are not affected.
As they deliberate on the pending trans student athlete cases, the U.S. Supreme Court might do well to consider a recent Journal of Pediatrics study. It confirms that trans young people who have access to gender-affirming hormone replacement therapies are demonstrably less suicidal. Researchers surveyed 432 patients aged 12 to 20 over 679 days. They found that suicidality significantly declined from pre-treatment to post-treatment, regardless of the respondents' gender, age, and duration of treatment. The authors say their findings provide clinical evidence supporting the mental health benefits of timely access to hormone therapies in this population. This latest research supports the positions of major medical groups in the United States: the American Medical Association, the American Psychiatric Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics, and the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. All say that gender-affirming healthcare is evidence-based and medically necessary for both trans adults and minors. The World Health Organization and the World Medical Association concur. Another mental health study was reported in December by the Trevor Project, a queer youth suicide prevention organization. It discovered that trans and non-binary young people aged 13 to 24 were 31% less likely to contemplate or try to kill themselves in the past year if their chosen pronouns are respected.
A Malaysian hotel advertised as gay-friendly on social media is now closed by order of the unfriendly authorities. The State of Malacca Religious Affairs Department and officers from the local Bachang Municipal Council raided the 37-room hotel on January 13th. No guests were found, and an unmade bed with two used condoms nearby in one room were the only signs of activity. No one who had booked the room could be found, according to the local reports. The Municipal Council nevertheless revoked the hotel's operating license and demanded that its owner explain the gay-friendly characterization on its website. In predominantly Muslim Malaysia, same-gender sex is punishable by up to 3 years in prison. That's in secular court. A religious court can sentence offenders with hefty fines and public whippings. Malaysia's anti-LGBTQ crackdown has been escalating over the past few years. 203 men were detained in a raid on an alleged gay sauna in the capital of Kuala Lumpur just last month.
The second term of President Donald Trump's administration is driving some U.S. LGBTQ people back into the closet. Almost 1 in 2 respondents to the Human Rights Campaign Foundation's annual LGBTQ plus community survey say they are now being less out somewhere in their lives. The organization polled more than 14,000 people across the country, two-thirds of whom identify as LGBTQ+. Nearly 1 in 3 of the LGBTQ+ people surveyed think social acceptance of queer people has diminished since the new administration took power. Bias and stigma in the workplace have also been reported in the last year by 57% of LGBTQ+ adults. Many of them blame the dismantling of their employers' diversity, equity, and inclusion programs due to the Trump administration's war on woke. Two-thirds of trans and non-binary adults said the administration's policies have made it more difficult for them to access health care. Queer people were also almost twice as likely as their heterosexual counterparts to say that their economic situation has worsened since Trump's January 2025 inauguration. Human Rights Campaign President Kelly Robinson discussed the report on MS Now's Morning Joe and issued a written statement that reads in part, "For all the pain Trump has caused, the LGBTQ+ community's resilience drives our power. Together, we continue to fight for a future in which everyone has the freedom to be who they are."
Finally, Trevor Project CEO James Black told the Associated Press, "I actually gasped." Their organization is getting a whopping $45 million donation from Mackenzie Scott, the billionaire philanthropist former wife of Amazon's Jeff Bezos. It's the largest single donation the 28-year-old life-saving queer youth organization has ever received. It comes at a time when the Trump administration's slashing of federal funding has all but shut down other queer youth crisis intervention groups. Scott donated $6 million to the group in 2020. CEO Black celebrated the new contribution, saying, "This historic donation from Mackenzie Scott comes at a time when the Trevor Project has never needed it more." LGBTQ+ youth in the U.S. are facing a growing mental health crisis, and the resources they have for support continue to be politicized and jeopardized. This gift provides a safety net for our life-saving suicide prevention and crisis intervention work, offering stability during a period of immense economic and political uncertainty. The $45 million is to be strategically invested to ensure the group's long-term financial stability. Black declares, "Thanks to Mackenzie Scott's extraordinary generosity, we are well-positioned to continue working toward a world where every LGBTQ+ young person feels safe, seen, and supported exactly as they are."
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude, for the week ending January 17th, 2026. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappelle, produced by Brian Teshazer, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Nico Raquel. Stay healthy.
And I'm Michael Taylor Gray. Stay safe.
Renee Nicole Good was murdered by a U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agent in Minneapolis, Minnesota on January 7th. Good was protesting ICE raids in her community, and her killing has intensified the worldwide movement against the Trump administration's attacks on immigrants. Except for the Justice Department's effort to prosecute Becca Good, Renee's spouse and family have been largely lost in the mainstream media din. Gay USA's Ann Northrup and Andy Hum aim to correct that omission.
The right wing and a lot of the world have refused to acknowledge that this was a loving couple and co-parents of this six-year-old boy.
I'll say something else. I mean, in the beginning, some right wing people were like, this looks out of line, you know? And then when they heard she was a lesbian, they dumped her.
Renee had been married first to a guy with whom she had two kids who are now teenagers and are living with him in Colorado, where they came from.
And he speaks very highly of her.
Very, very. Clearly, they had a good relationship. And then they divorced, I guess. She remarried a guy who is the father of the now six-year-old son. He died, that father. And so now that Renee has been murdered, people are referring to the son, the six-year-old, as an orphan. Well, he's not an orphan. He has a stepmother in Becca, who has been his co-parent, his other mother, for some years now. And as she says in her statement, she will be raising him. So to refer to him as an orphan, technically, he's lost his birth parents, but he is not an orphan. He has her, he has grandparents, and who knows how many other relatives. And the erasure of this family as a loving whole is just another horrible chapter in this story.
That was Gay USA co-hosts Ann Northrup and Andy Hum on the life and death of ICE murder victim Renee Nicole Good.
City at night, city at night, city at night, city at night.
Hello, I'm John Ritchie, author of City of Night, and you're listening to This Way Out, the international gay and lesbian radio magazine. I hope that you do stay tuned.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
Welcome and bienvenue. Welcome in cabaret, au cabaret, to cabaret.
While the world looks on with dismay as the U.S. government employs Gestapo tactics within its borders and imperialist threats abroad, This Way Out's Brian Teshazer is reminded of one of the great gay authors of the 20th century who lived through times like these.
Christopher Isherwood was born in England in 1904, came to the U.S. in 1939, and lived in Santa Monica from then until his death in 1986. His literary career began in 1928 with the publication of his first novel, All the Conspirators, and he's probably best known for the Berlin stories. Stories that fictionalized his life in pre-World War II Berlin and that were adapted as the stage play I Am a Camera and the popular musical Cabaret. And now let's listen to Christopher Isherwood reading from The Last of Mr. Norris and Goodbye to Berlin.
The Last of Mr. Norris is a book which describes a single character. Mr. Norris, who is a sort of gentlemanly crook, essentially a small-time crook, who is dabbling rather dangerously in deep waters. He plays around a little with espionage, with the communists, with various forces which are a great deal too big for him. He is by temperament a character who is much happier with a little modest blackmail and the arrangement of deals. This character is presented as a sympathetic character, and many have found him so, although as one critic once said, he has not one single redeeming feature. The eye of this novel, who incidentally is not named Christopher Isherwood, but William Bradshaw, which were the two middle names of my full name. I dropped them when I became an American citizen because Christopher Isherwood is quite enough load to carry through life without the other two. William goes to see him, at his suggestion, in Berlin. And this is a description of William's first visit to Mr. Norris's apartment. Norris had two front doors to his flat. They stood side by side. Both had peepholes in the center and brightly polished knobs and brass nameplates. On the left-hand plate was engraved Arthur Norris, Private, and on the right-hand, Arthur Norris, Export and Import. After a moment's hesitation, I pressed the button of the left-hand bell. The bell was startlingly loud. It must have been clearly audible all over the flat. Nevertheless, nothing happened. No sound came from within. I was just about to ring again when I became aware that an eye was regarding me through the peephole in the door. How long it had been there, I didn't know. I felt embarrassed and uncertain whether to stare the eye out of its hole or merely pretend that I hadn't seen it. I examined the ceiling, the floor, the walls, then ventured a furtive glance to make sure that it had gone. It hadn't. Vexed, I turned my back on the door altogether. Nearly a minute passed. When finally I did turn around, it was because the other door, the export and import door, had opened, and a young man stood on the threshold. "Is Mr. Norris in?" I asked. The young man eyed me suspiciously. He had watery, light yellow eyes and a blotched complexion the colour of porridge. His head was huge and round, set awkwardly on a short, plump body. He wore a smart lounge suit and patent leather shoes. I didn't like the look of him at all. "Have you an appointment?" "Yes." My tone was extremely curt. At once the young man's face curved into oily smiles. "Oh, it's Mr. Bradshaw. One moment, if you please." My astonishment, he closed the door in my face, only to reappear an instant later at the left-hand door, standing aside for me to enter the flat. This behaviour seemed all the more extraordinary because, as I noticed immediately I was inside, the private side of the entrance hall was divided from the export side only by a thick hanging curtain. "Mr. Norris wishes me to say that he will be with you in one moment," said the big-headed young man, treading delicately across the thick carpet on the toes of his patent leather shoes. He spoke very softly, as if he were afraid of being overheard. Opening the door of a large sitting room, he silently motioned me to take a chair and withdrew. Left alone, I looked around me, slightly mystified. Everything was in good taste, the carpet, the colour scheme, but the room was curiously without character. It was like a room on the stage or in the window of a high-class furnishing store, elegant, expensive, discreet. I had expected Mr. Norris's background to be altogether more exotic. Something Chinese would have suited him, with golden and scarlet dragons. The young man had left the door ajar. The gentleman is here, sir. And now, with even greater distinctness, Mr. Norris's voice was audible as he replied from behind a door in the opposite wall of the sitting room. Oh, is he? Thank you. I wanted to laugh. This little comedy was so unnecessary as it seemed slightly sinister. A moment later, Mr. Norris himself came into the room, nervously rubbing his manicured hands together. My dear boy, this is indeed an honor. Delighted to welcome you under the shadow of my humble roof tree. He didn't look well, I thought. His face wasn't so rosy today, and there were rings under his eyes. He sat down for a moment in an armchair, but rose again immediately, as if he were not in the mood for sitting still. The rest of this book describes how William gradually became involved with Mr. Norris and his plots and plans, and in the end very nearly got into some extremely melodramatic trouble. The book is basically melodramatic, perhaps one should say a kind of melodramatic political farce. My second book about Berlin, Goodbye to Berlin, is altogether more serious in its basic intention, although it contains a number of comic figures. The best known of these is the girl called Sally Bowles, and her story was dramatized by John Van Druten, my great friend, now dead, to make a play called I Am a Camera, the title being a quotation from a passage in this book. I'll read you now a description of my first meeting with Sally Bowles from Goodbye to Berlin. One afternoon early in October, I was invited to black coffee at Fritz Wendell's flat. Fritz always invited you to black coffee, with emphasis on the black. He was very proud of his coffee. People used to say that it was the strongest in Berlin. Fritz himself was dressed in his usual coffee party costume, a very thick white yachting sweater and very light blue flannel trousers. He greeted me with his full-lipped, luscious smile. "Hello, Chris." "Hello, Fritz. How are you?" "Fine." He bent over the coffee machine, his sleek black hair unplastering itself from his scalp and falling in richly scented locks over his eyes. "This darn thing doesn't go," he added. "How's business?" I asked. "Lousy and terrible," Fritz grinned richly. "Or I pull off a new deal in the next month, or I go as a gigolo." "Either or," I corrected, from force of professional habit. "I'm speaking a lousy English just now," drawled Fritz with great self-satisfaction. "Sally says maybe she'll give me a few lessons." "Who's Sally?" "Why, I forgot you don't know Sally. Too bad of me. Eventually she's coming around here this afternoon." "Is she nice?" Fritz rolled his naughty black eyes, handing me a rum-moistened cigarette from his patent tin. "Marvelous," he drawled. "Eventually, I believe I'm getting crazy about her. Oh, who is she? What does she do?" "She's an English girl, an actress. Sings at the Lady Windermere. Hot stuff, believe me." A few minutes later, Sally herself arrived. "Am I terribly late, Fritz, darling?" "Only half of an hour, I suppose," Fritz drawled, beaming with proprietary pleasure. "May I introduce Mr. Isherwood, Miss Bowles?" "Mr. Isherwood is commonly known as Chris." "I'm not," I said. Fritz is about the only person who's ever called me Chris in my life. Do you mind if I use your telephone, sweet? Sure, go ahead. Fritz caught my eye. Come into the other room, Chris. I want to show you something. He was evidently longing to hear my first impressions of Sally, his new acquisition. For heaven's sake, don't leave me alone with this man, she exclaimed, or he'll seduce me down the telephone. He's most terribly passionate. As she dialed the number, I noticed that her fingernails were painted emerald green, a colour unfortunately chosen, for it called attention to her hands, which were much stained by cigarette smoking and as dirty as a little girl's. She was dark enough to be Fritz's sister. Her face was long and thin, powdered white. She had very large brown eyes, which should have been darker, to match her hair and the pencil she used for her eyebrows. "Hello," she cooed, pursing her brilliant cherry lips as though she were going to kiss the mouthpiece. "Ist das du, mein Liebling?" Her voice opened in a fatuously sweet smile. Fritz and I sat watching her like a performance at the theatre. "Was wollen wir machen?" Morgan Abend. "Oh, wie wunderbar! Nein, nein, ich werde bleiben heute Abend zu Hause. Ja, ja, ich werde wirklich bleiben zu Hause. Auf Wiedersehen, mein Liebling." She hung up the receiver and turned to us triumphantly. "That's the man I slept with last night," she announced. "He makes love marvellously. He's an absolute genius at business, and he's terribly rich." She came and sat down on the sofa beside Fritz, sinking back into the cushions with a sigh. "Give me some coffee, will you, darling? I'm simply dying of thirst." And soon we were on to Fritz's favourite topic, love. He pronounced it larve.
You've been listening to iconic gay author Christopher Isherwood reading from The Last of Mr. Norris and Goodbye to Berlin. Thanks for finding This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. NewsWrap was reported this week by Michael Taylor Gray and Nico Raquel. NewsWrap producer Brian DeShazer also provided this week's Christopher Isherwood feature, with thanks to the Pacifica Radio Archives. Our thanks also to Ann Northrup and Andy Hum at GayUSATV.com. You heard music by Jethro Tull, Joel Gray, and Bronski Beat. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks Brad Furr of KGAY Palm Springs, California, Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley celebrating their 50th year together, and all the listener donors who make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappelle. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts, and on WRFI Ithaca, New York, 4BI Fortitude Valley, Queensland, KCEI Taos, New Mexico, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned, y'all.